You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. We're coming to you today from inside the Beltway, where the pollen count for trees is higher than it's ever been in 28 years. This is a threat to national security. Not really. But we do have some news for you this week. So let's race through it. Gazprom, which is, you know, Russia's energy giant under sanctions, etc., stock has plummeted. Its value has plummeted, I should say. It does appear that this is affecting the Russian economy. We'll see how this goes because there is a massive market for Gazprom products, and that's called China. Speaking of China, China has moved into the space game, as many of you interested in space law know. China's space station has been orbiting the Earth for the last 6 months, and on May 1st, a small capsule landed in Inner Mongolia with three Chinese astronauts. China was previously excluded from the International Space Station, which is going to be retired, by the way, at the end of 2029. So not to be outdone, China has announced it will allow former astronauts from countries other than China to join it at its new space station. So for retired astronauts seeking to stay relevant, many of them will sadly be attracted to that. And back in March, Hong Kong passed a new national security law that would heavily punish, quote, foreign interference in national security, rather ill-defined. This has alarmed foreign investment groups operating in Hong Kong, many of which have said that Hong Kong will become a far less attractive place for foreign business in the future. Now, the European Union is warning member nations not to become dependent on another Russian product of great importance, and that is nitrogen fertilizer. That obviously is a very important step in the EU, and where they're going to source nitrogen fertilizer is not entirely clear. But apparently, growing aware of the menace of Russia, EU official Thierry Breton has suggested a 100 billion euro public fund to lessen Europe's current reliance on U.S. defense manufacturers by dramatically increasing Europe's own manufacture of military hardware. You might recall our podcast with Simon Miles from Duke, wherein we discussed the lack of production of materiel by Europe and the threat that this posed to their collective national security. As well, Lithuania's armed forces have now received 50 U.S.-made JLTV armored vehicles, and they are looking to acquire another 300 JLTVs in the future. Lithuania is a former USSR country, which means, of course, that it is in Putin's crosshairs. Now, the Wall Street Journal reports that Starlink satellite internet services are being sold on the black market to Russian paramilitary forces and other not so attractive groups in Sudan. The article also suggests that Starlink could throttle that service if they choose to. Thanks for listening. All right, we're moving on right now because there is an amazing writer, a genius, I think, and Tracy does too, thank goodness. Last week we talked about Parable of the Sower, but there is a sequel to that, and it is Parable of the Talents. Why don't you, Tracy, give us a little hint of what is going on in Parable of the Talents that's different from Parable of the Sower? And I would add caveat, both Tracy and I are here only in our individual capacities, and we don't speak on behalf of any agency or firm.
Whereas Parable of the Sower was a book about movement, for me, Parable of the Talents is a book of grounding, of place. Having your found family and your biological family and all of the people you've gathered around you to grow together in a little town called Acorn. I'm not making that up. That's what it's called. And we see our main character, Lauren, a little older, definitely wiser, more geographically distant, in a stable romantic relationship with a partner of her choice, building that family. And then also the other thing she's building is her religion, a religion that is known by some as that cult, if they've heard of it, which most people in America have. And there's also some other political aspects that seem quite familiar. There's a political candidate who's running to make America great again. There are different religious factions, some of them calling themselves Christians, that are talking about their version of Christianity and how it is what's necessary in order to bring the country back to its original founding and really truly live out those Christian principles that will help America rise in greatness. And it's really against that backdrop that we see Lauren's world explode, for lack of a better word. There was beauty, there was stability, and then all of a sudden there is not. And it's challenging as a reader and challenging for Lauren as a main character. You might remember from our previous conversation how she suffers from a physical condition that causes her to feel the pain of others in a very real physical way in her body, even to the point of death. And there are a variety of scenes where she suffers in a spectacular fashion, and in one where she's assaulted. And that duality of feeling her assaulter's joy at hurting her, as well as the physical pain she experiences during the assault, is almost a microcosm of the totality of the book, you know, where you can see others engaging in these horrific acts, feel the pain of it, and also see their joy.
And on a meta level here, part of what has happened is America has fractured in the sense that people disagree with each other. They're in information silos and so on. And they've decided that there are, the political leaders have decided, and in particular, this one, Jared, that it is very important to win by dividing Americans. And it may be good for his campaign in the sense that he gets elected, but he's destroying the country and continues to destroy a country that's already experiencing rampant lawlessness, poverty, and by the way, is receiving aid at this point in the book from Russia.
And the practitioners of Lauren Oya Olamina's religion, it's called Earthseed, and they think of themselves, their holy books are called the books of the living. And I thought that was powerful because it's a recognition that the folks engaging in that activity, like what Elisa just described, they're dead. They're ripping the country apart and killing it. But there are also people who are living, trying, striving, but they suffer too.
It reminded me of like when you see a little flower that comes out of a crack in a dirty, yucky sidewalk somewhere.
Yes.
And she tries to build this little community, but you know, there's a maelstrom around her and she's a victim of her own success, quite literally. The national security theme that jumped out at me early in the book, because I think it took me a while to remember this, but when I popped it back open, it was the death of the meaningful fourth estate, something that we bemoan with some regularity on this podcast, that now we lack a lingua franca, that everybody's looking at their own news, creating their own reality. But there were a couple of quotes that really jumped out at me, and I'm saying this to Harvey. The people in Acorn get what are called, quote, news bullets. Does this sound familiar? That, quote, purport to tell us what we need to know in flashy pictures and quick, witty, verbal 1-2 punches. 25 or 30 words are supposed to be enough in a news bullet to explain either a war or an unusual set of Christmas lights. Bullets are cheap and full of big dramatic pictures. The whole business makes me long for free broadcast radio, which, by the way, is dead at this point in the book, like the kind we had when I was a kid. But that's almost non-existent. Society is fractured into different realities at this point. Among other things, children and women are sexualized and enslaved wholesale all over the country. So I would note first, Death of the Fourth Estate. And Harvey, I don't know if you've read this one. It's really something. If you haven't, I can commend it to anyone. Tracy, what are your thoughts? What do you see?
I think it's really powerful that you brought up the meaningful fourth estate, because part of Lauren's power and part of her danger is that her very being is one of truth. The religious teachings that she develops are grounded in logic. Like, this ties us back into the three body problem, because there is a role for logic in all things, in my view. And I think Octavia Butler would agree, even in questions of faith, because if your faith tradition is telling you that what you should do is contrary to your emotions and your logic, then Lauren's religious teachings would have the community come together about that and have a conversation, and then you keep talking about it until, even if you don't agree, which is completely fine, you understand why everyone else disagrees. And that level of mutual understanding is what she has built within her own community. And the people she encounters are hungry for that type of feeding. And in an environment like what Elisa so perfectly described, there's no other venue by which you can get that type of dialogue. And it's not even because what she's sharing is faith-based, in my opinion. It's because it's based on thinking, logic, listening. And if the facts change and you listen to them, maybe your opinion should change too, which is quite radical in an environment where there is only those truth bullets that centralized state media, the tearing apart of those institutions at the individual, family, state, or other micro level within a pseudo federal government, because I would argue that at that point, America is a failed state. Because the government that's in place is not providing those necessary services. It's acting in a very realistic way, in the sense that it's buttressing up the individual needs or goals of different entities, but it's certainly not any one agreed upon United States government goal.
And it's experiencing secession, right? I mean, Alaska is seceded and it's going to go with Russia. And again, politicians for short-term gain continue to fuel divisions, but it is a fully failed state. There are no social services left. There are no police and fire. There's no educational system that has gone by the wayside. And the only people who have access to any of the things that we enjoy day to day right now in the United States are people who have substantial means. Harvey, did you have a thought on that?
First of all, the parable of the talents and Susie when I grew up was Matthew and Luke. So the issue is how the play on words is for the novel about what the parable is that comes from the New Testament on the parable of talents. But the second part is your fourth state issue. Years ago, one of the few books that the Harvard Government Department could actually agree on that juniors should be taught was On Liberty by John Stuart Mill. And the assumption was, is that On Liberty was something where there would be no censorship and that you deal with bad or poor information with more and better information. But it assumes a level of rationality that I think is an assumption that's hard to make in our current 21st century. And what the book puts forward, people are clearly having their own different reality, their own different view. And if the description of Twitter, the 25 words that was now X, that's all that's needed to convey information, loses a word that most of my students can't spell, which is called nuance. And that is something that we are losing rapidly. And I just say, just look at the coverage of the student strikes at the universities. And I ask you, who has the ability to come forward with a nuanced position? And what is the betting line over and under that the president of Columbia will be there in the next couple of weeks, depending on how she handles this sort of speech event?
Yeah. And to your point about nuance, I did find it fascinating that of all things on Bill Maher on Friday, he had access to an interview of one of the students who actually wasn't entirely sure what the goal was. And that interview was really something. We'll see where we are, you know, in another 10, 15 weeks of this. But the coverage of it is, there's no nuance. I would wholeheartedly agree. The other thing is, and I want to say this book was written long before
1998 was when it was released. So,
yeah, I mean, really there was no, this is not to reference specifically Trump, but the important thing is the phrase "Make America Great Again" was one sort of conjured by Virtek, and it was used in the run up to World War II by the people who were trying to promote Nazism in the United States and keep the United States out of World War II, the theory being that once we entered, it was over. It's interesting that that's the phrasing that he uses in the book, the Make America Great Again. But I thought it was interesting that what happened is the Earthseed faith discusses change. One of the issues that you see with this Christian Americans is they have this idea, this is Christian Americans, not right now and in the United States writ large, but this group that identifies themselves as Christian Americans in the book, they are all about things being very rigidly this way or that, whereas Earthseed's philosophy is God is change. Change is obviously one of the consistents in the universe and in all humanity. And so that is part of the underpinning of the faith. And this group wants to go backwards. This Christian America group wants to work backwards to something, this golden age that never existed. And they label themselves in Christian, and every single thing that they do violates all New Testament rules, period. Tracy, would you disagree with that?
No, I don't disagree at all. But, and I appreciate you bringing up, Harvey, the parable of the talents, you know, because that is definitely Octavia Butler's intent in naming after the famous gospel story told by Jesus of Nazareth, specific to good and faithful servants and evil servants. You know, what do we do with the talents, in this instance, the money that's given? You know, right. But of course, to my family and children, a talent is, you know, a gift that you've been given. How do you use it to benefit yourself, to benefit others? Do you take this money your master gave you? Do you make more money? Do you make it the same? Do you lose and squander it all in cruelty? I mean, that is absolutely the entirety of the book in a postage stamp type of version, talking about God being changed through the lens of a fictional narrative, and to read those words that are also the words that, you know, it's what some religious traditions see as a holy prophet being used to describe the extrapolation of 1980s American policies put in place by the executive branch in the 1980s, because that's where all of the policy comes from that is extrapolated by Octavia Butler, which goes to the genius piece to me. So there's some great interviews by her that were promulgated by NPR, and I think they're still out there on the ether if somebody wants to look those up, where she talks about how she didn't make anything up. She just sat with the policies that were passed by Congress in the 1980s and then just tried to imagine, you know, what the third and fourth order effects of those policy changes would be. For me, a lot of what science fiction gives us is examples of what you can control within the scope of your own ability to enforce and make change. And here we have a religious faith that recognizes the change swirling around us and doesn't encourage you to have all the answers, only to affect and deal with the change in a way that comports with what you're feeling called to do in alliance with your talents. And I think that's really powerful and a lesson that we could all take forward today in some kind of small way.
Well, last week we talked a little bit, but I think just to remind listeners, this Jared presidential character is sort of viewed as a messiah. And part of it is that people have come to believe just their individual contribution, their choices would never make a difference. And that is clear. They're looking for a savior for sort of the wreck that has become America without any sort of thought. It doesn't appear, at least in the characters, the few characters that we get some insight into who are part of the CA movement. They don't see their own roles in this. So that's like one. Two, I think one of the interesting things about how this comes to be, though, is also something that I don't want to omit from our conversation, which is that lawlessness has become so rampant. It becomes acceptable to people to have these armed gangs that would put something around the neck of an individual who probably isn't, no criminal tendencies, and subjugate them in such a way and put them in camps with no rights, subject them to all levels of abuse, that people seem to just be willing to ignore that in order to deal with what is essentially an encompassing crime rate, I guess, for lack of a better term.
And we've seen that in our historic past as well, in the sense that children are taken from families and given to, quote, good Christian homes. And that's a quote from the parable of the talents. And there's a section that talks about how these children are taken away to be re-educated, to accept Jesus Christ as our savior, Jarrett's crusaders as our teacher, Jarrett as God's chosen restorer of America's greatness, and the Church of Christian America as our church. Only then will we be Christian patriots worthy to raise children. I mean, it's language that could be torn from a headline today, but it was published, as you said earlier, in 1998, extrapolated from policies that were concerning to Octavia Butler at that time. She also used historical events like what you just mentioned, Elisa, and I'm sure you already know this, of taking away children from, quote, undesirables for re-education. And that's something that has reared its incredibly ugly head over and over again throughout human history.
Context is everything, right? She's a Pasadena resident, which is, you know, a suburb of Los Angeles. It's mostly white conservative. It's where Walt Disney lived. And it did have a, you know, a very robust Black middle class and upper class. And she comes from that town. And her first book came out in 1993. And I would just emphasize again that Los Angeles had burned. There had been massive massive riots. And those riots went all the way into Pasadena. They happened all over. There were full streets, Vermont Avenue, for example. Some of them you could just see for miles, they were burned. And George Bush had to, in his estimation, call in the National Guard. The Insurrection Act was invoked. And the Guard came out and restored order. But the thought of rampant lawlessness and this image of burning had to be fresh in her mind, that the potential for the fabric of society to tear over something that finally upsets a portion of the population, it had to be something. And then the response to the riot that ensued, you know, the increasing of all the laws that punished things like a third petty theft as a felony with a potential serious long-term sentence. She was watching all of this as she was writing these books, and they unfolded in earnest through 1998. If you look at when a lot of those laws were passed, it was right in this time. And I'm sure she was able to project forward to a dystopian version of that, worse than what she perceived was happening in the moment. And I think that fueled her imagination. But if we write every law based on a period of time or an event, again, you know, I think the national security concern may be that we could create a situation that we don't want for the future. And this gets back to the Supreme Court, darn it, because they were thinking ahead, those guys. And it was mostly the guys who had a few comments. They were like, you know, I don't want the president's hands to be tied. I'm concerned about that.
For me too, Lisa, because I care a lot about decision space. You know, I'm in the Navy. My heritage is I will fight to the death for this scrap of decision space to remain with my on-scene commander on the waterfront, you know, commanding at sea, commanding ashore, responsible for all souls aboard and for mission accomplishment. And I will do that every day, twice on Sunday. And to hear somebody say, you know, let's make sure that this discretion is intact in a circumstance when you're like, well, you know, it doesn't mean that the only thing they get to do is have discretion. This is not the first time we've had these conversations, not between the three of us, not between lawyers 100 years ago, probably not between people back and back and back. And I think that's what makes these pieces of literature so powerful and important, you know, because it's these human themes that keep recycling in new and unique ways, but yet clinging to the trappings of old, so that we can continue to have these conversations in different environments, so that we can hopefully, as I like to say, make some new mistakes instead of the same old ones over and over and over again, you know. But I'm just glad that we can talk about it, because if we're all talking about these books, reading about these books, thinking about these things, I mean, even if not all of us, just some of us, I think that's positive.
So back to the Supreme Court. Jared here does all kinds of things, right? This is the president of the United States in the book. And he allows all these things to happen to children, to women, these encampments where everybody that they perceive is different and doesn't buy into their Christian philosophy, which is all a facade in this book. These are not what any serious person of faith of any Abrahamic religion would say is a real thing. These people serially abuse others and hold slaves and believe in forced conversions and the like. So having put that out there, but the point is, what happens when Lauren achieves any freedom is she learns something, which is that everything that has occurred to them is actually illegal, but it was allowed or directed by Jared. Harvey Tracy, with respect to the Supreme Court and whether or not this is in his role as president or outside of his role as president and what immunity might be entitled to, discuss.
Well, you have to remember every democracy has as part of their constitutional framework the concept of the suspension of habeas corpus and rights. We have it written in our actual constitution in Article 1. As you know, when Lincoln does it, the constitutional question is that, oh, that has to be an act of Congress and not by the president. And then retroactively, the Civil War, they condone that event. The French call it raison d'état. So the French have the power to suspend rights when the state is threatened and democracy is threatened. And the British have POGG, peace, order, and good government. So every state, actually great democratic state, has this capacity. And I know Tracy is a classical buff. So that Caesar's assertion of the suspension of him becoming Caesar/Czar in order to defend the Roman Republic is a long tradition. I guess for me, the big issue, Alisa, is who gets to define when that moment comes to the point in which those rights have to be curtailed to defend the institutions. That is the dilemma, but it's built into our constitutional documents, and it is something historically has happened occasionally in all of our democratic histories.
I think it's wonderful to start with the Constitution. It's something I always try to do in my daily work, as silly as that may sound. You know, what are you doing at this echelon three command thinking about constitutional principles? But that's because my Navy, the Department of Defense, of which I have been a part for almost 18 years, you know, that's one of the parts of it that drew me as a very junior lawyer, you know, 18 years ago. Is I didn't want to pledge my mind and my abilities to a person. I wanted to pledge them to a set of ideals, to a governance structure, to concepts that had been articulated in writing and then argued about in all kinds of different forum from bars to back alleys to vaunted halls of Congress. I wanted to be part of that, to carry on those conversations.
It's interesting, but I will say this, and because we do have to move on, I just want to say one thing, which is that the vicissitudes of politics in the United States strongly suggest that our adherence to a set of objective principles, which have stood, for the most part, the test of time, despite technological changes and despite changes in culture, is probably a better way than for us to base our practice of law and our loyalty to any one individual. I appreciate you both. You're both wonderful and amazing. And I hope you come back a lot and do this with me again.
Well, thank you
great
so much.
Seeing you,
so much fun. Good seeing
thank you.
Thank you,
Tracy.
And thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to share this episode with a friend if you get through it, and to discuss any of the topics that we've covered tonight with others in a thoughtful way. Make sure you hear other people's opinions and arguments. Believe me, it will improve your skills as a lawyer. And remember, a key feature of our national security is our unity in a country with more diversity, both of persons and thoughts, than any other. Our producer and writer is me, as well as your host, yay, Alisa Poteet, but I'm always here in my individual capacity, not on behalf of any agency or firm. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is the ever lovely, amazing Holly McMahon, as well as the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, including Rishikoff himself, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Thank you for suffering us. Come back next week.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.